Work session, House Bill 2014, Senate Bill 106, Senate Bill 107, Senate Bill 111, Senate Bill 114, and House Bill 2936.
Will come to order. The clerk will note those members present. The balance are excused. First item on the agenda for work session is House Bill 2014. Dennis?
This is one of the interim committee bills. We'll help get through subcommittee three.
It was tabled for a while in subcommittee three.
By operation of the rules. Juvenile parole. And it sets statutorily standards which of procedure which would be followed in the case of juvenile parole and revocation of juvenile parole and eventual ultimate release of a juvenile from parole custody. The standards generally arise out of the case Morrissey against Brewer and Gagnon against Scarpelli. They're patterned closely after the parole procedures in the adult statutes. Subcommittee made certain recommended changes, which are in your hand gross bill, which I distributed to you. And if you want, I'll take you through the bill bit by bit.
Please.
Okay. I'll do that mainly by reading and summarizing. The first section of the bill, you can focus on section 2 on page 2. It says that within 30 days after the admission of a student to a juvenile training school, at least, I'm reading the Andy Gross part now, at least once every 30 days thereafter, until the student is ordered discharged for parole, there shall be a periodic review to determine whether the determine the progress of the student toward readiness for release on parole. So every 30 days, they check the student to see how the student is coming toward readiness for release. Upon finding that the student is ready for release and that a suitable placement is available, and after advising the committee in court, the student would be released on parole. Release would be subject to conditions of parole, which would be in writing, and all proper parties we should be informed of those conditions and some of these conditions, which are pretty much listed from the adult statutes, are listed on lines 24 through 33. After student's release on parole, in many cases, conduct occurs which could give rise to parole revocation, whether it be new crime or antisocial behavior of any number of circumstances which would indicate that the parole is inadvisable and the student should be brought back into the institution. The bill addresses some of those kinds of behavior. It says that if the PSC authorities have reason to believe that the condition of parole has been violated and there aren't substantial reasons which justify or mitigate the violation or make revocation inappropriate, there shall be parole revocation proceedings. If the alleged violation of parole is an act for which the parolee could otherwise be taken into custody, the parolee may be taken into temporary custody and placed in a juvenile detention facility, or if not practicable, returned to the juvenile training school. What that means is that if it's new crime, you can pick the kid up and put him in detention. Or if there's no detention facility that's practicable, you can bring him all the way back to McLaren or Hilton. Otherwise, the child would be left out on parole pending a preliminary fact-finding hearing to determine whether or not there is probable cause. Within a reasonable period, if the child is not detained, and within 3 judicial days, if the child is detained, there shall be this preliminary hearing. to determine probable cause. The intention of the subcommittee is that the preliminary hearing would be conducted as near the place of the alleged violation as practicable, and that it might be conducted by the juvenile court. We did check with the juvenile court to see whether there were courts who would be willing to serve this function, but it's permissive. The parolees may waive that first stage hearing. And prior to the hearing, there is a formal communication of rights and allegations. This is all pretty much taken out of the adult statutes and runs all the way down the page. There's a right to counsel, right to subpoena witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. And then those rights that are told to the parolee that the parolee will have those rights when the hearing comes around are repeated at the bottom of the page 3 and the top of page 4 that they will occur at the hearing. At the conclusion of the hearing is to be a finding. And if the finding is that there should be parole revocation, they go to the next step, which is a parole revocation hearing. Within 20 days, there shall be a parole revocation hearing. Now, that's generally at the training school. And the same kind of rights apply, right to counsel, etc. And at the conclusion of that hearing, a decision is made whether or not to revoke parole. The decision is communicated. There is a possibility of appeal to the Court of Appeals of whatever decision is made. And on page 5, there are some procedural. There's some procedural language that describes preparing what is included in the record for purposes of going before the Court of Appeals.
Where's that language drawn from? Is that from is that just new, or is that something out of a present procedure in adult court? Or?
I believe that's from the interim committee report in Senate Bill 2. I don't think that it is adult word.
Is there anything else that's not in there that we might consider to be added to be part of the record?
I can't think of that. Section 6 on page 5 allows a waiver. The child can say, hey, you got me. I'm ready to go back to McLaren. I did it. Why go through the whole process? And Section 7 deals with the fact that eventually the student will be ready for release outright. And Section 8 talks about the limits of the period during which a child may be kept on parole. Eventually, even if the child isn't really ready for parole, the grasp of the state over the child terminates by operation of law because the child gets too old or he serves more time than he would have, or a time equal to the time he would have been serving a war crime, or the other conditions listed here. And then there's a repealer of existing very brief parole statutes because they would be replaced by this bill.
What's the present procedure as opposed to this procedure? What happens?
It's administrative. If you want a description of it, FNCSD people do administer it.
Okay. I guess my next question is, we're talking about a two-tiered approach, which is a preliminary hearing and then a full-blown parole revocation hearing.
Right.
Type approach. There's nothing in either Gandy versus Cartelli or Morrissey versus Brewer that requires two hearings, is there?
I believe. Well, I'd say yes, but I'd like to be backed up on that by Julie and Charlie.
Yes, there's a requirement for.
Do you want to come up and identify yourself?
My name is Julie McFarlane with Legal Aid. There's a requirement in Gagnon v. Scarpelli for probable cause determination initially, and then the full-blown hearing. At the probable cause, I believe it's Gagnon, at the probable cause hearing does not require that the parolee be allowed to present mitigating and justifying circumstances, and that's really the purpose of the full-blown hearing, is to present mitigation and justification where there has been a determination of probable cause already.
Mr. Chairman, maybe this witness would be the appropriate one to talk to again. It seems to me that the notice provisions for the preliminary hearing on page 3 are more extensive than the notice provisions for the charging of an act which would bring the child within the jurisdiction of the court. Speaking with regard to subsection 3 at line 12, and then looking at A, B, C, D, E, F under that, that is more complete than a simple petition would be, which gives the person or the child notice in a regular proceeding. Is it necessary that there be so much more notice and so much more in the way of discussion?
Are you referring to D specifically, or?
Well, typically a petition would contain A, it would designate B, it wouldn't tell them they have a right to it, it would designate it. C does not apply. D is certainly one of the things that, and E would also be unusual.
Because
D and E are a little more than would be required if the person were just being charged outright with what would be a crime.
Yeah. I think the reason that these are in here is because when the interim committee was drafting this bill, they were uncertain as to what rights did apply in a parole revocation hearing versus a criminal or juvenile hearing in court. I don't think that those are necessarily necessary for the notice, as long as it's clear that they are the right of the child. Another thing that I think... I would say that, there's no reason to take it out, and it's good to have it in that many juveniles will be defending themselves rather than being represented by attorneys. Or be considering defending themselves rather than being represented by attorneys, so they need to know these rights, which they're not going to ordinarily know they have. And to have it in the notice puts it right there. I think it's a good practice.
The language that you're looking at is from the adult statutes, and the reason it's in the adult statutes is that it was set up with that degree of specificity in the court case.
Okay.
So that's the genealogy.
I'm comparing it rather than to other parole proceedings, to the original initiation of an adjudicatory proceeding, at which point the notice is required for that. You're charging burglary in the first degree, a Class A felony, and you don't need to set out with that kind of specificity the details of the charge.
I'm sure that the reason for that is historical, that the Supreme Court didn't consider a case in the same frame of mind that it had when it considered the revocation cases, and didn't feel a need to come up with a degree of detail.
I guess I'd submit that I would feel that this burden or breadth of notice would be appropriate, both because we're talking about a potential deprivation of liberty, and we're talking about a juvenile already in trouble with the system, released and on his way back out of the system, and what that risk with a determination of revocation of parole is, a potential irretrievable path in connection with the system, and this is a critical point, whether that juvenile stays with the system or doesn't.
Well, is it less a critical point than his original entry into the system?
I would say this would be, I would feel like this is the point at which a difference could be made in whether that juvenile stays with the system or gets out of it for good.
I think you have to take consideration of the fact of the really different nature of the proceedings when you're comparing a juvenile delinquency adjudication versus a parole revocation. Juvenile delinquency adjudication, you have the two-tiered procedure of first conviction on the crime or whatever it is, and then the disposition. You don't have that here. So that in one proceeding, you're going to have the presentation of both the factual basis for the revocation and any mitigating or justifying circumstances which might keep the child in the community despite the act that he's done or allegedly done. And so that there's really a different kind of proceeding altogether. It also is an administrative proceeding as opposed to a court hearing.
Further questions? Do we have a summary of the testimony before the subcommittee from the bill?
No.
It was voluminous, Mr. Chairman, over many evenings and work sessions. The principal concern I think the subcommittee had on the bill, as I explained it, is that there currently is litigation pending in federal court over a number of different procedures that are involved with the Claren, Nuthard, and Gilchrist. And parole procedures are only part of the various allegations of constitutional deficiency present in the state's system of dealing with juveniles. Your editorial comment is ignored. And one piece of that suit is the adequacy of the present administrative rules of the Children's Services Division with respect to providing due process to juveniles in parole revocation procedures. Mr. Massey sent legal aid, along with Ms. McFarlane, who are parties to that suit, and Children's Services Division told us earlier in the session that the procedures were in the process of revision. There does not yet appear to be any definitive revision of those procedures that's been presented to the committee. And the ones that we have looked at do appear, in fact, to be suspect, if not actually deficient. And it was, I think, the intention of the subcommittee to pass the bill out of the subcommittee and give CSD one more chance, if it wished, to respond to the bill in terms of specific objections to the various changes that we have made in the bill since it was introduced.
Is there someone here from CSD? Do you want to take your last shot at the bill at this point in time?
Yes, Mr. Chairman,
I am informed that you were present during the hearings in the subcommittee and did not testify.
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't be fair to the witness. He did testify at one hearing, perhaps two, but we did have, including the work session just a few weeks ago, there was no one present from CSD.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to
be appropriate. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Richard Peterson, and I function as general superintendent for the training schools in Pearl. With your permission, I'd like to pass out a two-page piece of testimony and a copy of a rule that's being developed in relation to the federal suit, which we intend to adopt within the next 30 days or so. With me also, and at your disposal, is Leonard Monks, who is the Director of Juvenile Parole, and Catherine Kelty, who is with the Justice Department, who has been involved in the development of the rules and procedures which presently govern parole revocation practice in the Children's Services Division since December of 1974. If I may, I'll simply read the testimony that I provided to your committee and comment on it.
Yes, we have sent this.
Yes.
Yeah. I'd like to mention, Mr. Chairman, that we were unintentionally absent from the last session of Subcommittee 3. We simply didn't get the word, and we did it to ourselves. And we apologize for that, since the committee's time is valuable. We immediately, upon learning that we had been absent from a subcommittee session, my staff obtained a copy of the session, went over it in careful detail, and the paper that you have in front of you is an effort to say what we should have said and would have said to contribute to the committee's work at that time. We point out that there was concern in the last work session for the Children's Services Division management of the parole revocation procedures. We believe we've been in conformance with the Morrissey decision since December of 1974. On that date, in a circuit court of the state of Oregon, Judge George Van Humusen presiding ruled that the state of Oregon Children's Services Division should have adult-type parole procedures in the juvenile area. We then returned to that court, stipulated under the advice of the Attorney General that we would do this, and with the assistance of Ms. Kelly, prepared and provided to the court a set of procedures to comply with the court's directions. Since that time, we've all learned a lot about Morrissey versus Brewer, and I think have learned a lot about due process procedures. We didn't do it real well right at first. We think we're doing pretty well now. We're advised by the Justice Department that within, with one exception, one problem which I'd like to share with the committee, we're essentially, according to their judgment, in compliance with the law as it relates to revocation of juveniles with current case law. The problem that I'd like to share with you is the problem of site hearings.
Site hearings or on-site?
On-site hearings. In other words, if youngsters in Portland or the Grand and appears to have violated the conditions of their parole, and we might wish to have a preliminary hearing, and as would usually be the case, it would be wise and prudent to assure their detention and custody. There is not, in the bulk of Oregon's geographical area, a suitable place to detain youngsters. And if there is, we have no power to require that the local juvenile department detain the youngsters and hold them for a hearing, and we are not budgeted to reimburse them should they agree that they had the space to hold them for hearings. There are, I believe, people in the audience who can speak to that. I believe there are two juvenile department directors here, and perhaps they will assist me. There are, what, six juvenile detention facilities in Oregon which do conform to the sight and sound provisions, and if they are not all already oversubscribed in their usage, I think it would be reasonable for us to believe and to recommend to you that probably there will be a shortage of such space within the immediate future and competition for that space. Our rule provides that where possible and feasible, and I would interpret that to mean to, in the best interest of the youngster and public safety, we would hold on-site hearings. Would be our desire to do so. However, if there were an improper place or a place ill-fitted to provide proper care for youngsters, i.e. a detention facility that did not meet the sight and sound requirements, and if the only other alternative were to fail to provide proper supervision and result in the youngster running away and perhaps damaging both themselves and others, we would return the youngsters to the state facilities as being the best choice available where trained staff and appropriate facilities would be provided them while they were waiting for the hearings. You have been provided with a copy of the rules which we have been developing in relation with the to the federal suit, and I think the rule, the implementation of the rule, will provide for some increased costs. It will be our task, and I believe we can meet it, within, if providing the governor's recommended budget goes forward and is generally funded at that level, to absorb these costs for the implementation within the rule within existing funds for 7981. We do point out that implementation of the 2014 as written will have, in our estimation, the cost attached to it. Our estimate is based on the, primarily the experience in the adult system as to number of requests for the various level of hearings and for and the waiver experience with attorneys. We estimate the cost to be about $516,000, which does not include whatever it might cost to purchase appropriate local secure care for youngsters while awaiting hearings. We chose simply to reference an approximate figure per day and did not feel confident that we would be able to fairly project the cost out for the noise reference.
I want to be precise about this now. You're saying that the estimated fiscal impact, what, biennial or annual?
Biennial.
Biennial would be $516,000?
Yes, sir.
But you're projecting that on the basis of adult parole revocation procedures?
Yes.
And I'm wondering whether that's an apposite comparison to use.
I believe this is that the analysis is the best and truest analysis within our ability to make. I have with me here today also Mr. Lee Cornforth, who has prepared the analysis and worked about a year on it, and I'm sure he would be available for detailed questions on exactly the logic and the data that were used in forecasting this estimate.
Setting aside for the moment the fiscal impact of the bill, do you have any something's going to have to be done. You are attempting to deal with this with your proposed rule. We presently have this bill before the committee. Okay. I don't know what the committee's going to decide to do. Perhaps we'll allow you to go ahead with your rule, and perhaps we'll preempt you and pass the bill. As far as the substantive provisions of the bill are concerned, excluding the fiscal cost of the bill, do you have any comments, criticisms about the bill that you want to share with us?
Well, if the bill is passed, as a loyal citizen, I would do my best to operate within it. My personal opinion is that it's very close to what we presently practice and would like to practice, 30-day review. Much of what is in the bill we agree with. I do not personally believe that there are great wrongs to be righted in Oregon which would require, for example, non-waivable counsel. I think the bill does require, if I'm not mistaken, that side hearings be held. I've shared with you the problem I see there. Perhaps the language covers the problem or doesn't. I think experience would have to dictate. Probably the only other observation I would make is that case law does seem to be developing rather rapidly in the juvenile area. A decision I haven't seen come down regarding counsel or due process at parole hearings just come down. Yeah, it would kind of change things a little bit. The problem, I suppose, with putting all this in statute might be over time as things changed and more due process or rights were added or taken away, it might be necessary to, on an ongoing basis, theoretically amend the statute. Well, I suppose it's easier to amend the rule and to file a rule than it would be to make statutory changes. Those are the only observations I would have, Mr. Chairman.
Well, the bill basically requires that the parolee be taken in temporary custody and placed in a juvenile detention facility, or if not practical, returned to a juvenile training mm-hmm. school. Mm-hmm. I don't see that as requiring an on-site hearing. Your proposed rule, however, speaks of holding the hearing at a place that is in the best interest of the child, mm-hmm. which may very well be an on-site hearing. Mm-hmm. So it seems that our bill probably gives more flexibility as far as not requiring an on-site hearing than your proposed rule.
maybe we should change our rule. I tend to agree with you.
Representative Fromar?
I just can't figure out where the cost differential would then lie between your proposed rule, which is in many ways more rigid, and the statute.
We don't. Our proposed rule does not require the state to pay for counsel.
So it's no. In fact, that's one of the things that leaps out of the page is a difference, which is that you allow a staff person, not associated with the case, to act as the child's representative, but you don't provide for the appointment of counsel. Now, is it the case that the appointment of counsel is required by 2014 is, in fact, the major cost component?
That, I think, in general, would lift the revocation process to, we believe, to a level of formality that would begin to consume manpower, attorney general fees, travel witness fees, this sort of thing.
Okay. How many parole revocations do you have in a year again?
Let me get some data on that.
Well, I'm giving you an order of magnitude.
We're running about
38 a month.
About 38 a month?
38 a month, so you run that over.
Adult parole runs about 60 a month, juvenile about 38.
Okay, if you had 500 a biennium, so that's $1,000 per revocation. On the average?
Is that fair? Lee says that.
But you got waivers through about three quarters of those, don't you?
I understand from the work that we've done on it. I don't have the material in front of me. Maybe I'll ask Lee to join me with the chair's permission.
Well, we better get a secure answer to it. I think now's the time.
Lee, would you join me? Did you hear the last question?
No. Well, let's assume 500 biennium, which is, I guess, somewhere on an average that we can depend upon. And you figured out the cost at $510,000 per biennium, so that averages out to $1,000 per child per revocation. But it is the case, is it not, that most parole revocations are handled in an informal manner with respect, or at least that the child waives it, and that therefore there's not the occasion for the full-blown hearing.
At this point, yes, that's true.
So where's the cost?
If we were to continue our revocation system as it exists now, we'd be able to hold that cost without having the responsibility for attorney costs, estate expense. I think that's probably the one major cost in the whole assessment. That's the major one. At this point, we don't have it.
The experience, Mr. Chairman, in the adult system was that as the state provided counsel tended to be used more, and there were a greater number of appeals for formal hearings. This is the information we have from
One final question, and I'll pass it on to others who want to ask questions. What, in your judgment, other than the appointment of counsel, is the major difference between, or differences between, your proposed temporary rules and House Bill 2014 as amended by the subcommittee?
This would be the major one.
I think that's the major difference.
Okay.
Representative Mason?
So you figure counsel will run about $1,000 a year?
We're estimating on count. We have the
appointed counsel run $1,000 a hearing.
I can solve
the problem, Representative Mason. If you have counsel, if we move to that level of formality, I don't think we can continue to function with group life supervisors and untrained staff conducting hearings. We're going to have hearings officers, as does the adult system. We're going to have to get probably a greater involvement with legal counsel to respond to the expertise and energy of the defense counsel. And so the cost estimate, which has been provided to the committee, includes not only estimates for attorney fees, which are probably conservative at about, what, $35 an hour?
$30 an hour.
We get that estimate from the experience that the adult system has in their payment schedule.
They're paying $30 an hour?
A standard fee of $30 an hour with a maximum of $150 per case. So that's what we have.
So that would be $150 for the defense attorney then, and $850 for the state?
Witness fees, transportation of witnesses, detention costs in some cases for youngsters, and then the hearings officers and staff to provide for this level of formality.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just, for the record, I would like to make a statement. I think that the people that these fiscal impact statements are just about enough to cause me to vote for the bill right off. In the sense that, we're having witnesses come in and shoot these fiscal impact statements at us, and I don't know about the rest of the committee. I see a few heads nodding, but it's not making us very well disposed, because it's becoming the, you know, the number one torpedo in this process is the fiscal impact statement. In fact, it's, you know, it's you got a fiscal impact statement, I got a fiscal impact statement. You get a whole handful of them there in some bills, but that's it.
Okay. I have a question at this point. You say you had 38 revocations a month. Is that correct? How many of those revocations is the hearing waived? How many waivers do you have out of 38?
I have some experience for a recent period of time. We had 40, let's see.
Just give me 1 month.
All right. Can you grab a figure off of this? The waivers? I'd say the majority of them were waived. But we had, in one period of time, involving 40 requests, there were, or 40 revocations, 26 were waived.
So you had 14 potential hearings on 40 cases. Okay, so we're talking about, instead of 40 a month over a buy-in, you've got perhaps 15 a month where there would be a hearing over a 24-month period.
We believe that as the hearing became more formalized, that the request for formal hearings would increase, which is the experience in the adult system. And that's the basis of our projections, not our current experience.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I think your experience would have to agree with that as well, that when there's a formal procedure set up, most defense counsel are not going to just automatically waive the proceeding. They're going to go through the motions on every one of them to perpetuate the record for whatever it may develop, and you won't see very many waivers. So I think you better, if the fiscal impact is the hang-up, you better allow for the maximum amount of minimum.
Okay. Further questions or comments? Mr. Bucus?
I noticed from some material that we have in front of us, the legal aid folks have a memo, which is sort of in recent. Oregon Legal Services Corporation has a memo response to, which is a partial response to a memo originated by your department, and they say that they feel that the procedures what you discussed in your memo that have been instituted in response to the Morrissey decision are not in good faith, but rather in an attempt, issued in an attempt to settle the federal lawsuit that's presently undergoing, that's presently in the mills, entitled Gary H. et al. Versus Richard Davis. So would you respond to that?
Yes. I'd point out that Oregon, in a circuit court in December 4th, 1974, I believe well in advance that Washington had already made the decision that the state of Oregon would provide such hearings for juveniles. And in essence, although it's more refined, the proposed rule that's being worked with in the federal court is that rule. So Oregon made that decision well before the federal system entered into this matter in Oregon. Now, personally, who knows what evil lurks in someone's heart on this matter, but I'm committed as a corrections person. I can have no other position but to follow and respect the law. How else could I, you know, administer these programs?
What's the status of the Davis case? Gary H. against Richard Davis case.
You know, those are one of the plaintiffs in the federal court.
I understand, but what's the date? When was that filed?
The federal suit, the date of the filing, do you have?
Well, considerably after Morrissey, wasn't it?
It was well after the federal court in the state of Oregon required that we do these types of hearings.
I'm not arguing, Mr. Chairman, but is it not correct to assume that you might not have that case filed? Because I understand I haven't read the case, we don't have it, but it's my understanding that some of the objections, some of the relief sought in that case, probably would not have been sought had you complied strictly with Morrissey. Is that correct?
Well, we have a difference of opinion on that. We do not agree with the people filing the suit that we are doing this process wrongly. They believe that we are.
Well, at least you have some indication, or you've given us some indication that you've again modified your rules. You say you've got a set now in the mill. You haven't even properly adopted them under the APA. That tells me that you at least felt some more modification was in order. Is that correct?
I think the answer to that would be that we are continuing to refine basically what we were doing. We're doing a better job. I don't think we've changed anything fundamental from what we did originally. And I would like to ask counsel, Attorney General, to agree or disagree with the statement.
It might be helpful, Mr. Chairman, if we could have the counsel for the department in there for just a moment or two.
Very briefly.
Chairman.
Richard.
Just a short note while we're waiting for the witness. At 15 hearings a month for 24 months and $300 per hearing for the double hearing for each case, plus $300 more per case for the administrative cost to the division, we're still only talking about $216,000.
Yeah.
Compared to $560,000.
Well, the committee says, what are you getting $300?
Ma'am, do you have something you
want to
add?
Well, only if the committee wants to hear something. We did formulate some rules after we were in circuit court with Judge Bantams. The procedures conform to Morrissey. In the best thinking of the Department of Justice, we did conform to the requirements of Morrissey. And procedures were adopted after a consultation with the adult parole people and followed the procedures that they used substantially. The only, since this lawsuit was filed, one of the things that has been going on is a complete revision of the rules and perhaps an expansion, but basically, fundamentally, there are not any major changes, except that there is disagreement over the provision of counsel. I'm sure this committee has already heard testimony. And Gagnon versus Scarpelli does not require does not make it mandatory to have counsel in all parole revocation hearings, and that, of course, is what this bill would do. And I think that's the major difference. Gagnon versus Scarpelli says it's neither necessary or advisable. Well, it says, although the presence and participation of counsel will probably be both undesirable and constitutionally unnecessary in most revocation hearings, there will remain certain cases in which the state must use some discretion. That's all that case says. It does not say that the counsel must be provided in all hearings. Now, the rules that these rules that are being adopted now have been worked on for a number of months, and they are intended to satisfy the U.S. District Court that the agency is giving all, providing all due process requirements to the children. And this case will only be completed.
Mr. Chairman, I can't. I'm sorry. Can I ask my colleagues to please not talk in one ear while I'm trying to decide how to vote, and I'm trying to do it in good conscience.
This court case will not be finally settled until the U.S. District Court is satisfied that the procedures do comply with the requirements of due process.
Representative,
you do not feel that either Morrissey or Scarpelli, and unfortunately I have not reviewed the cases in detail, I've just heard references here, you're convinced in your best legal judgment that neither Morrissey nor Scarpelli mandate counsel in every case in a revocation?
That's true, absolutely. I can quote you from Gagnon versus Scarpelli, and the language is absolutely clear.
May I ask another question, Mr. Chairman? In your judgment, have you been attached to the department for some while?
Yes, sir.
In your judgment, is it good advice to have an attorney in most cases, or do you feel as that dictum, is that dictum or is that the essence of the decision in your judgment, that part you read out of Scarpelli?
Well, that was just one of the considerations in the case, and that was what the court said with reference to the provision of attorneys. Of course, Morrissey versus Brewer very carefully did not consider the provision of counsel, and as I remember, there is a footnote in which they say we're not considering this. It was the Scarpelli case later on that did consider the problem of provision of counsel.
But you think that was essential to the main thrust of the judgment in the Scarpelli case?
I believe so. I believe it was an important part of the judgment.
Well, I don't think there's any question, Mr. Chairman, and the witnesses too, that if we mandate an attorney in every case where the juvenile has the possibility of a parole revocation, that there's going to be a very significant cost factor. And I can't argue whether the $1,000 per person accuracy or figure is accurate or not, but I believe that Representative Smith makes a good point. If there is if this is kind of ringing the bell of due process, and if we invoke this mandate with our legislative action, there is going to be a very, very significant cost impact. And I don't find $1,000 per case particularly disturbing. I'm not able to attack it or defend it, but $1,000 in defending a person's rights to freedom, if we view this situation as one that needs defending in every case of a juvenile, possible revocation of a juvenile parole like this, then I don't have any trouble buying the $1,000 cost. But I am interested in the fact that we have a complete divergence of opinion as to what these cases are, at least what I've been led to believe up to this moment. The case law told us on this. In fact, I've got some notes here that says that Morrissey requires on request, there's a quote out of Morris, it says, on request of the parolee, a person who has given adverse information on which parole revocation is to be based is to be made available for questioning in his presence. Now, that's not right to attorney, that's right to confront your accuser.
We don't question that.
Have you costed out what it would take to implement this bill if we mandated that in every parole revocation case?
Yes, I believe we have.
What do you think that cost is?
Do we have a good estimate? This is a cost for witnesses,
yes.
Representative.
Yes, I understand.
We've estimated a cost of subpoena and mileage for witnesses at $28,140, considering all of the hearings that we have. That's based on $15 per hearing plus mileage costs of approximately $8.40 per witness.
That per annum? Or
that's a biennium.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fromm.
Move House Bill 2014 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Frommeyer's moved that House Bill 2014 as amended be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Representative Frommeyer?
I want to speak to it. We've had the floor of committee since January, and every single time we've had a hearing or a work session, the rules are just around the corner, they're on the drafter's table, they're almost done, and it's now 4 months later. And we have a draft of rules that aren't even going to be proposed as temporary rules for 30 days. Won't even go up for hearing on permanent rules for 60 days after that. And of course, we'll be gone out of session and the press will be off. And I just feel that the problems can't have been so insurmountable that we couldn't have dealt with this problem, preferably without legislation. There may be some things in 2014 that are difficult for the division to work with, but I frankly lost my patience with it. And I think that ample time has been given, and assurances have been given that I feel have not been validated by the actual experience that we have had as a committee with the division in getting this thing moving along. So I'm going to support this. I'm going to support strongly. And I think the only way we can smoke out what a new fiscal impact is and then take a good look at it is to get the bill to the floor and test it. So I'm sorry it comes to this, but I've really had it.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richardson, Representative Mays.
Thank you. The figure that I first quoted to you was based on maximum cost per hearing for private counsel and $300 per case for public expense, and recalculating it on actual hearing time that is usual and customary puts the cost down now at $72,000. These are as valuable as any fiscal impact statement we've received on this bill.
Yeah, just before I recognize Representative Mason and Representative Rutherford, I would say that just from what little I know about the process, that your figure of $516,000 is rather high. Representative Mason?
Well, I'm going to vote for the bill, and I've had some discussions with legal aid, and I would hope that they would, in their federal suit, not pursue those portions of that suit which have been ameliorated by the passage of this bill, should the bill pass, that they base their suit on due process grounds and try to keep the federal court out of legislating for the state, and that those portions of the suit which might have to do with punishment or work without pay or the other aspects can be pursued, and they would back off on the procedural aspects of it with a few exceptions that we've discussed. I think that that will ameliorate the situation, and I concur very heartily and very strongly with Representative Frommeyer's observations.
Representative Rutherford.
I was wondering if the bill had a substantive referral to Ways and Means.
No, and that's been a matter of discussion up at this end of the table anyway. It'd be my intention that should the bill receive 5 votes to come out of this committee, that I will be immediately in contact with Representative Gilmore and be taking a look with him at the budget for CSD to see if this bill, if the impact of this bill is significant enough in light of their budget and what they've done with their budget down there, that we should send it, when it does come to the floor, two ways and means.
Well, it would be important to my decision because I'm concerned about the fiscal impact that the bill has, and I don't think I could support it unless I knew that it was going to Ways and Means.
Well, it may very well go to Ways and Means. It's something I will be talking to the chairman, co-chairman of Ways and Means, and make him aware of, and also perhaps the chairman of the subcommittee that has the CSD budget in it. Is there further discussion or some views?
I move to amend the motion to move HB 2014 out of the committee with the due pass as amended recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I'd like to discuss it. My motion.
Okay, Representative Bugis moves to amend the motion to provide that the bill be sent due pass to Ways and Means. Representative Bugis?
Well, I have perhaps due to my own inattentiveness, but for some reason I have gotten the impression that the two court cases we discussed at tremendous length mandated the attorney assignment. And I see we definitely have mandated it in this bill. There isn't the slightest doubt that every single youngster who's considered revoking is going to have an attorney from now on should this become law. And to assume that that isn't going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think, is to be dishonest with ourselves and the public. And on page 3 of the hand-committed version of G3 sub G, we mandate it very clearly. And that isn't the only additional cost. And I too am critical of the departments. They haven't rewritten their rules, or at least haven't given us evidence that they've rewritten their rules to comply with the cases we've discussed at length. But the facts are, we're missing part of the point of our charge down here as legislators. And I am certainly not going to vote for the bill if it can go anywhere else but Ways and Means. And I'm not convinced that I'm even going to support the bill on the floor with the mandated attorney in it. I do think we've got some correction to do, and we've got a lot of it to do, but we're not going to, I'm not going to vote out of hand for a bill that costs this kind of money without properly funding it.
Well, I was going to say, additionally, I would expect that there would be some fiscal impact on local governments, which is, I think, another matter for our consideration. I haven't heard it discussed yet today. I just mentioned it's before the committee.
The only thing that I would say in really opposition to the motion is that at least with one other bill, we took the approach that the chair suggested, and that was with Representative Zajon's bill. And I did discuss that bill with Representative Gilmore prior to the time that it came to the floor. And it was his opinion that it need not go to Ways and Means. Is there further discussion on the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Mayor Strohmeyer?
No.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
No.
Richard?
No.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Davis?
Aye.
No.
No. Fails. The motion is now by Representative Strohmeyer to send House Bill 2014 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Strohmeyer.
I think that Representative Higgins and I have the same objective, and perhaps the same thing will occur, but I just think it, for purposes of what needs to be accomplished, that this is a cleaner way to do it. I think that a discussion with the co-chair of Ways and Means would be very fruitful in smoking out precisely what the facts are.
Further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Which
Representative Mann, speak with it further, Mr. Chairman.
What's in front of
I hadn't finished. If you close this Ways and Means with a subsequent referral, there will be, as a practical matter, no discussion of this bill in the rest of the session, I'm convinced. If, on the other hand, this bill goes to the floor with the proviso that we ourselves can move it there, then it will be called to the attention of Ways and Means fiscal staff and the co-chair of Ways and Means with respect not only to the fiscal question, but the substantive policy question that we're attempting to move off dead center. And I think that that, in my role as a legislator, is what I want to see come out of this exercise, whether 2014 ever passes through both houses of this assembly or not. I'm just tired of seeing the issue buried in the subcommittee and judiciary, and the last thing that needs to be done is bury it in the subcommittee in Ways and Means. I think we ought to push it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bugis, I think you got in under...
Well, I... If there were a way to pass it out of the House, pass it through the House, and then to Ways and Means, I think we would make our message very clear, and I think Ways and Means would pay attention. But I believe this technique of obtaining, not only ignoring the cost, I feel compelled to call the attention of the members on the floor the cost factor, if it goes out this way.
Well, there may very well be a motion prior to the bill ever being debated on the floor to send it to Ways and Means. And I would be certainly the one that would make that motion, because I've consistently taken the position that Ways and Means should at least be aware of those things that come out of the committee that have potential fiscal impact. So on that basis, I think there's a good chance that it will end up in Ways and Means. It's just a question of how it's going there.
That's what I was going to say. I think there's no question what the motion will be made one way or another on the floor to send it to Ways and Means. I just don't think that's going to avoid anybody here. Why is that not the going to go? The motion will be made there.
I guess in a way we're really kind of saying we're a little more interested in this one than perhaps some that just happen to get voted here and go to Ways and Means directly.
By way of comment, I'd like to address a question to our colleague from Eugene as to the status of procedures and their constitutionality without this policy statement, if this bill were to fail.
Well, the Administrative Procedure Act requires that an agency have rules for the things that it does, and to kind of pull something out of the desk drawer that's constantly being massaged and updated, that's never gone through the rulemaking procedure, might itself be subject to challenge as not having been adopted with reference to applicable rulemaking procedures. And an agency policy which has not gone through rulemaking procedure, at least under the APA, is in low force effect. And the APA does require procedural rules for agency procedures to be adopted through the APA. Should have been done a long time ago. And I'm just not happy to see that it's been delayed without an explanation that's satisfactory to me as to why there's a delay and why there should be a 30-day delay before it's made a temporary rule. In fact, I don't know that you can find a justification for making it a temporary rule if you tell us now that you're going to do it as a temporary rule and then wait 30 days before you do it. Because to adopt a temporary rule, you have to show an immediate danger to public health or safety in order to make the proper recitations and findings that justify using the temporary rule process as opposed to the permanent rule process. And if you're telling us now that 30 days from now you're going to adopt a temporary rule, if I were court, I'd throw it out. I don't think you have the basis for the legal findings required under the APA to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Very briefly.
The process of involving ourselves with federal court since that time has been one which we have accepted the guidance of the people who are working with us in court. And the guidance is, because they're involved in dialogue with the people suing and the court, not to file a rule until all of that input has gotten in and been reviewed by the court. This is my best understanding of the delay. I'm aware that a delay has occurred, but apparently this is the way the matter is best managed in federal court, and I feel badly about that.
Further discussion on the motion?
Question.
Court call roll.
Person Smith?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Richards?
Aye.
Manson?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Ronmeyer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Bugis?
No.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Okay, next bill on the agenda is Senate Bill 106.
Senate fast, don't we?
Okay, we should be working with the B engrossed version of Senate Bill 106.
Okay.
What the bill does in its present form is allow the juvenile court judge to sentence a child who's 14 or over to a detention facility for children from 5 p.m. Friday to 5 p.m. Sunday for a maximum of 4 weekends, in addition to any time that's already been spent in such a facility. If the child has been found to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court by reason of having committed an act which would be a crime, or violated a condition of probation. Now, Section 3 puts a limitation on that, saying that it can't be used unless there's sight and sound separation in the facility from adult prisoners, and unless it's staffed by a juvenile department employee. Section 4 provides that it can only happen after a court hearing. Judge Norblad, who testified on the bill, did not like the fact that the Senate changed the detention time to weekends. The Senate's rationale for doing so was so as not to disrupt the school or work life of the child, depending on whether the child was in school or working. Judge Norblad said that most of the children, 60% of the children, he says, that he deals with are out of school for one reason or another. Now, of course, if they're truant, it seems like it might be a good idea to try to get them back into school rather than putting them in a detention facility. But Judge Norblad's suggestion is that it be either 8 straight days or 14 straight days, or presumably an option to do it on weekends for a child who is in school. To give that kind of flexibility so that the judge could do whatever seems right for the child.
Well, if we went to a permissive system, the judge could require 8 straight days rather than had to, then the judge still would retain the power as the judge of the juvenile court to order that whatever time to be served, if there was time to be served, would be on weekends.
Yeah, I mean, to just say the juvenile court may order the child age 14 or over to be placed in a detention facility for children for a maximum of 8 days.
Okay, the chair would make that motion. Is there discussion, Mr. Chairman? Person Mason.
I have a relatively strong memo here from Senator Foy, and I think I can read it to you. This bill is in excellent shape and represents a compromise between those who don't like the concept at all and those who want a much harder line than juveniles. The bill went back in the Florida committee to make this compromise. I think the concept is important. It's used judiciously and would appreciate a vote to send the bill on as presently amended. So I would like to almond sip of the bill as it is.
Anderson Longworth.
I've had some communications, of course, with my judge, Judge Sawyer, on this. And quite frankly, I think he sees the bill as next to useless in its current shape, because as Joan pointed out, in these situations, most of these kids are not in school and are not working. And so it makes little sense if you're looking at an in-between remedy, a remedy in between out-and-out probation and McLaren. It seems kind of silly to say that, well, you can sentence the individual to detention this weekend, but then you got to put them out on probation for the week and then put them in another weekend. It just takes all flexibility away from the judge, and I just can't imagine what the Senate's thinking was on this, other than explaining that, that perhaps there might be interruptions in school, but again, it seems to me that making it permissive, my gosh, if a judge feels in a dispositional proceeding that a kid has been going to school or wants to ensure that the kid will go to school, the common sense thing is to give the judge the power to do that, and like the district court judges or circuit court judges have today, they can order work release or order service time on weekends, but this just seems to be ridiculous to tie the court's hands in this way, and I can't support the motion. Actually, Judge Sawyer would prefer to have the option of going to 14 days rather than pulling back to 8 days, but I, you know, prefer to compromise. I could buy 8 days, but I sure would prefer to go back to 14. So I'm going to support your motion.
Yeah, it seems to me that the purpose of the bill, at least as it was explained to me by Senator Meeker, was really to, it was kind of a shock sensing type of a program. And if, you know, you're going to put someone in for 2 days and let them out, maybe even in the case of someone in school, there should be a little disruption, because when we put people into jail when they're adults, or we put them in McLaren, then there certainly is a great deal of disruption, and it's a lot more than 8 days worth. Sometimes it's for 30 years. And that's what really, I think, in the final analysis, that this bill is attempting to obviate the necessity down the road to basically do that. Now, maybe in 99.99% of the cases, that's not going to occur. Maybe it won't have that great of an effect, but it seems to me that to take the kind of cavalier approach that the country club approach, as it were, that we only do this on weekends and that we don't really want to disrupt anybody's life is going a long ways from what the bill was intended originally to do. Is there further discussion?
Are you moving to toughen it up, Mr.
Chairman? I'm moving to allow for 8 days consecutively as opposed to 4 weekends.
Joan? We do have suggested language from the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency, which would be in line 6 after children. Delete the rest of the line in line 7 and insert. After children, insert for a maximum of 8 days. The time in the facility may be spent on 4 consecutive weekends or continuously, whichever the judge determines to be the least disruptive and most beneficial for the child.
I think that just by making it permissive, you've done that, because I think the judge retains the power to determine how it can be served. If you limit it and say that it's only to be, you know, he can do it only in the case of 4 weekends, then you don't give him the discretion to make it consecutive. But if you say that it can be served 8 days, for a maximum of 8 days, then he has the power, basically, to do something that's less restrictive, as I see. Is there further discussion on the motion? I assume there's going to be objections, so the clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards?
Excuse me, I was out of the room. Could you restate
that? The motion is to change from 5 p.m. Friday to 5 p.m. Sunday for a maximum of 4 weekends, to allow the judge, in his discretion if the case warrants it, for 8 consecutive days.
Detention?
Up to 8, Mr. Chairman? Up to 8 consecutive days.
And what is the weekend problem?
Language as it's written would not allow the judge, even in an appropriate case, to have 8 consecutive days. It would require that the most discretion would have would be just weekends, whereas my language will allow him the discretion if the case is appropriate for weekends, but if it is appropriate, 8 consecutive days also.
Longmore? The way I understand you phrase your motion, though, is up to a maximum of 8 consecutive days. If you use the word consecutive, then you remove the option of weekends.
It's not my intention to do that.
Okay, so I think really what you are saying is simply to allow them to place the child in detention for a period of time not to exceed 8 days.
That's correct. Thank you for restating my mind.
Actually, you got it there. The original bill reads, I think, exactly the way it's probably wanted for the 14th.
haven't got the statute.
For a specific period of time not to exceed 8 days.
Okay. Okay. The motion is after children to delete the rest of that language and weekends in line 7 and to insert the language for a specific period of time not to exceed 8 days. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
President Cohen?
Aye.
Cromer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
No.
Richards?
No.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Davis?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. I'm sure there'll be a conference committee on this one.
Move the bill to the floor to do pass the amendment.
Representative Dugas moves the Senate Bill 106 as amended be sent to the floor for due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Dugas? Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Cromer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Okay, the next bill up is Senate Bill 107.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chairman, language on page 2 of Senate Bill 107, line 30, gives local government some problem with respect to the jail standards bill, which we had passed out of this committee and passed successfully in the floor of the House of Representatives. Language, specifically the language on line 30, speaks in subsection 4, speaking to standards promulgation, line 30 talks about established by law or regulation. We establish jail standards for facilities by law as a matter of statutory policy in House Bill 7073, and the language or regulation is particularly troublesome to local governments because they're concerned that that language could possibly result in a double set of policy or standards that they may have to comply with. So I would move that we delete the language or the words or regulation on line 30, and then I would have further comment on the bill.
Okay, Representative Richards moves that line 30, page 2, Senate Bill 107, that the language or regulation after law be deleted. Is there discussion?
As a technical matter, I wonder, Representative Richards, if that's going to do it.
Yeah.
Because established by law includes a valid and promulgated regulation. And so with that, looking all through the amended bills, the court looking at this wouldn't necessarily know that your intention is to preclude state agency mandating mm-hmm. permits in addition to that. If you said by statute, that might do the job, although then you might have the problem of dealing with federal regulations, which would probably supersede state law, and which would require compliance. I know what you're trying to say, but I just think that the amendment you proposed is perhaps not quite enough to do the job.
Mr. Chairman, I would accept and appreciate a recommendation from the committee for a conceptual motion that would make it clear that we are concerned about. Actually, you know, maybe we're wasting time because the intention of the committee in the Senate is that the jail standards bill that was passed be adequately amended to encompass the goals of Senate Bill 107.
Mr. Chairman, I have different information from that.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay.
As I understand it, the amendments were presented to the Senate committee and were not favorably received. They haven't been acted on yet. Diana says there's absolutely no guarantee that 2073 will be amended. And obviously we know there's no guarantee. Some of the people on the Senate committee are concerned that 2073 would be messed up if the juvenile stuff is put in. So it's not correct to say that
okay.
that's going to happen. That's apparently a controversial issue over there.
Mr. Chairman, I guess at this point I would just call, I would like for the committee to hear from the representatives of local government who have concerns about this legislation.
Okay. Local government likes to step forward, whoever they
be. No one hiring, or someone else carried about.
We've got all the taxpayers.
Right, Mr. Chairman, the last bill we had conversation between motion, or in mid-motions, if you remember.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Nancy McCain with the League of Oregon Cities, and Robin O'Brien with the Association of Oregon Counties. Get it right there. Our concern deals with the language that Representative Richards was addressing in the bill, and that is the possibility that we would be dealing with a number of administrative rules that could be adopted by any agency that was concerned with jails, juvenile justice, whatever. Right now we are mandated to deal with the statutory standards in ORS 169, which apply to lockups and to local correctional facilities, and which have been stiffened under the provisions of House Bill 2073, which I'm sure you have not forgotten, although you may have tried. That bill is now before Senate Judiciary. Lee Penny has suggested some amendments to the bill. No action was taken by the committee, and we feel that we would be more comfortable with having standards spelled out in statute rather than being open to having to deal with unknown administrative rules.
Okay.
We're willing to work over there to get those, some of those, you know, if we can deal with them, and we've called some of our people and they feel fairly comfortable with most of them, we're willing to work with the committee over there.
After discussion with Representative Frohmeyer, I think that if we delete the word law and insert the word statute, that would take care of your problem.
Would you say then, would it be established by statute or regulation?
No, law or regulation. Strike law or regulation and substitute the word statute. I'd make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Unless that was...
That's a friendly amendment to Representative Richards' motion.
Received very friendly.
Okay, is there discussion on the motion as amended? Is there objection to the motion? If not, it's adopted. Is there a motion on the bill as amended? Representative Cohen moves that Senate Bill 107 as amended be sent to the floor for due pass recommendations or discussion. If not, the court will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Dugas?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Okay, the next bill up is Senate Bill 111.
Chairman, I'd like to suggest that Lee Penny be asked to go through the long bill and everything in the first one.
Let's take a 5-minute recess. We're in recess. House Committee on Judiciary will come to order. The clerk will note those members present. The ballots are excused. Next item on the agenda is Senate Bill 111, and after discussion with Representative Lombard, who has some amendments that he would like to present to that bill and also have public input, that bill will be held over and returned to Subcommittee 3. Will be heard next Thursday. At that time, the Subcommittee may take up his proposed amendments. Representative Lombard.
Might I also announce for the benefit of those in the audience who I know are interested in this, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm trying to sneak one over or slip one over on you, Ed. What I intend to do is have witnesses present to testify in support of the so-called Sawyer proposal for extension of juvenile court jurisdiction to parents. I've asked them to address themselves specifically to the concern of the governor's task force on juvenile corrections, the constitutional question of whether or not we can extend this jurisdiction. But it seems to me that this bill dealing with disposition, it's an appropriate bill to consider this possible extension of dispositional jurisdiction, and so I just, for the public record, saying that that is the issue that I intend to present for discussion next Thursday morning, and certainly would invite any witnesses' comments on that proposal. I've handed members of the committee copies of Senate Bill 779 from last session, the 1977 session. The committee staff will have a copy of that bill, and if you wish to see the proposal in writing in advance of Thursday's meeting, you can get a copy, I'm sure, from committee staff. Joe can have a copy of that. That, in essence, will be the proposal.
Mr. Chairman.
First problem.
Yes, again, for the public record and those present, I have a letter in my possession which I'd like to give the staff to have duplicated for that hearing, which deal with two minor questions about the time and whether time limits specified in one portion of the bill are, in fact, adequate. And it would be my intention to ask the subcommittee at least to consider that letter with reference to possibly expanding the time limit, the judicial days allowed on page 4, from two judicial days to some period that might permit defense and prosecuting attorneys to work together a little bit more effectively. But that's not, again, one that I would intend to scuttle the bill with. I just think it's a practical problem, and I want to call everybody's attention so we don't have any confusion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I received a letter from Judge Foster of Lakeview on this bill. I assume the other members of the committee did too, but I just wanted to mention it and make sure you did.
Could you have it made part of the record, Bill?
Sure.
So Bill has that first.
We'll now take up Senate Bill 114. Joan?
I think you sent it to all of us.
Senate Bill 114 deals with informal disposition for juveniles. Informal disposition is the most common thing that happens in juveniles, and for kids who have been referred to juvenile court, and happens approximately 80%, possibly 80% of the children are dealt with informally. The bill provides for uniform standardization of dispositional, of informal dispositional arrangements. What it does is allow an informal disposition agreement to be entered into between the child and the juvenile department counselor when the counselor has probable cause to believe the child may be found to be in the jurisdiction of the court for one or more of the acts specified in 419-476 is the juvenile court jurisdictional statute. A is crime, B, I forget what B is, F is runaway. Please, I'm forgetting A, B, and F of 419-476. But there it is. I know A is what would be a crime and F is runaway, and I forget what B is.
Lee Penning, Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Corrections. A is a crime, B is beyond parental control, C is behavior condition or circumstances endangering welfare, F is runaway.
Okay, the informal disposition agreement is an agreement between the child and the juvenile department counselor where the child agrees to fulfill certain conditions, and in exchange for that, the counselor agrees not to file a petition against the child in juvenile court. And subsection 2 of section 2 sets out what the disposition agreement may require. Section 3 gives protections, basically, that the agreement will not last longer than 6 months. It will be voluntarily entered into by both parties. It's revocable by the child at any time, revocable by the counselor if he has reasonable cause to believe the child has failed to carry out the terms of the agreement. Not the admission of guilt, not to be used as evidence against the child, to be in writing, to be signed by the counselor, the child's parent or parents or legal guardian, if any, and becomes part of the child's juvenile department record. then Section 4 says that if it's revoked, if the agreement is revoked either by the child or by the counselor as reasonable cause to believe the child has broken the agreement, then the counselor shall file a petition with the juvenile court and a hearing will be held.
Chairman,
first and foremost,
some questions. Maybe Lee, you could be of assistance to us here. This is revocable by the child at any time, and there are no conditions attached to the child's ability to revoke it. Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that, in essence, while the state is bound or juvenile court is bound by the conditions, certain conditions spelled out in sub 4 of section 3, while the child is in a different position.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's suppose the child revokes it. That automatically triggers the requirement that the juvenile department counselor file a petition.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose your condition 3, under which I could imagine that the child would revoke it, and the juvenile counselor may say, well, you know, it's revoked because essentially there's no real need to follow through on it. But then it apparently doesn't leave any discretion with the counselor as to whether or not the petition for the adjudicatory hearing must then be filed anyway.
Yeah, if they shall, then it would simply be a matter of court dismissal of the petition. If in the court's opinion the child had essentially satisfied the terms, or there was no real reason to proceed on the basis of the petition.
Okay. Now, is there any such thing contemplated here in Section 3, Sub 3, the revocation by operation of law? That is, what kind of writing or conduct or statement is sufficient to revoke such an agreement?
Would the child revoke?
Yeah. Can the child say, I'm going to California and I revoke, you know, call up long distance from LA or Reno, or do we contemplate here that the child actually must, in order to trigger this whole operation, must have submitted the child's revocation in writing?
It wasn't contemplated exactly how that would be done. It could be, of course, in writing. If the child absconds from the jurisdiction, there's no doubt what the counselor is going to revoke.
Well,
the terms of most of these would be, of course, that the child remain available to the court unless they got permission, special permission, to travel away from the court.
Okay, I'm just wondering whether there is any advisability to say the form with which the child must revoke the agreement. Now, I guess I would rather see the revocation be required in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you're going to have swearing contests as to whether a fit of bad temper constituted an actual revocation or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that Ted, I take it that your nod means you think that might improve it.
I would think in writing would be quite acceptable, yes.
Okay, along that same line, or same kinds of concerns, Section 5, line 36, the counselor may modify the terms of the agreement in lieu of the revocation. That modification must be in writing, I would take.
Right.
And final question is, I take it from the way the wording is on the last of lines 37 and 38 that the child has to agree to the modifications.
Yes.
So we're not, it's not really the counselor's unilateral modification, but the counselor may...
It would be essentially the same as the original agreement. It is a consensual agreement on the part of the child. And if, for instance, the child thought that the modification was too onerous, the child could at that point refuse to agree and go before the court. If
okay.
the child thought there was any advantage to him in formalizing it and going before the court, it's just a matter, 99 times out of 100, the child is not going to do this, of course.
Yeah.
But it's just preserving the person's right for his day in court if he's going to, if he wishes to exercise that option, and if he's going to submit to certain restrictions on his activities, associations, liberties, etc.
Okay.
So that it is essentially a consensual agreement.
Okay. Chairman?
First and foremost.
Chairman, I would move, conceptually, that in line 20, Section 3, Sub 3, that the instrument, the agreement be revocable by the child in writing at any time. Now, I'm not, my motion hasn't gone on to specify where that writing should be submitted, whether it's to the counselor or to the court, because I don't know enough to make an intelligent choice, but it seems to me that at least it ought to be in writing.
Okay. First, and Promar moves conceptually that the informal disposition agreement be revocable by the child at any time in writing. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Very nice.
Mr. Chairman,
Joan.
At the subcommittee hearing, Representative Lombard presented some amendments that were given to him by Judge William Beckett. I think you might want to hear Lee's comments on the amendments after I read them to you. The first proposed amendment is on line 5. After County Juvenile Department, you put in a period and delete the rest of the section. His rationale is it's difficult enough for judges to determine probable cause, and untrained counselors ought not to be placed in this position. I assume, Lee can correct me if I'm wrong, that the reason that the language, all that language from lines 5 through 9 is in, is that there are only certain circumstances under which a child and the counselor should be allowed to enter into this informal dispositional agreement, and that those are limitations, so that the task force did not intend that any time a child has been referred to a juvenile department, this informal arrangement can be entered into. Mm-hmm. I would assume.
It's not the intent here that this involves neglect, abuse, abandonment cases, only cases where the child is accused of some act, but not parental neglect. Or
this is happening informally all the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
yeah.
All of this is really going to do is formalize to some degree the process by which this already occurred.
Judge Beckett's second proposed amendment is line 20, just to delete line 24.
Is Representative Frommeyer's judgment and suggestions?
Well, he seems to be looking all over my office for this letter. Thank you.
Okay. You should just tell people to send me a memo before.
Are
you?
Judge Beckett's reason for thinking that line 24 should be deleted is that if the agreement is part of the juvenile's record, which is section 3G, well, it is on line 29, becomes part of the juvenile's record, it ought also to be considered by the judge in the dispositional hearing. That sounds sensible to me. I don't know.
It says adjudicatory, though. I might agree with you on dispositional hearing, but I don't agree with adjudicatory.
Okay. Set for those who's only suggestions.
No. Set that section 6 should be deleted. Section 6 requires the juvenile department counselor to inform the child and the child's parents or guardians of the child's right to counsel. And to court-appointed counsel, if indigent, the right to counsel shall attach prior to the child entering into an informal disposition agreement. What it says about that is if an attorney is appointed, it's doubtful that an informal agreement could be developed. The appointed attorney, as a matter of obligation, would be trying to have no petition filed and no further action taken by the department, or the attorney would be forcing the department to file and prove the allegations, knowing that even if proven, the ultimate disposition would differ little from the terms of the informal agreement. Issues of restitution, community service, and treatment would take considerable time and bargaining, which ultimately would detract from the benefits supposedly to be derived from an informal approach. Has not met an adverse statement about attorneys. Quite to the contrary, attorneys by their very nature and training find it difficult to treat anything informally. Thus, there is a built-in conflict in attempting to establish an informal process and include attorneys as part of the process.
Mr. Chairman, I object to that suggestion.
I move.
So does Representative Rogers.
Well, if the count can be a deletion of sections.
Well,
I'll explain my opposition to it.
You can give it a try. Do you want to make that?
I'll move it. Yeah, let's see what it is.
Representative Frohmeyer moves that House Senate Bill 114 be amended by deleting Section 6 on page 3 of the bill. Is there a discussion? Representative Frohmeyer, to your motion, or do you just...
I think the judge set forth considerations.
Representative Cohn's
question. There's cost consideration.
Since I was not a member of the subcommittee that heard this bill, I want to just clarify for me when this court appointed counsel, under what circumstance, what are we talking about here? Just in, at what point in the process are we talking about the juvenile counselor informing the child of right to counsel?
Prior to any kind of petition ever being filed, which would be a departure, at least in my opinion, from present practice, because as I understand now, until really there's a petition filed, there isn't any court-appointed attorney that's required or is in a matter of practice.
That's probably right.
That's the point at which, at least I've gotten it.
One more question there. What's the advantage of having the attorneys in that early, before a petition is even filed?
I think it has something to do with at least some people's view of due process.
Before the petition is filed?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you can avoid getting a petition filed, you're that much farther ahead.
Okay.
Representative Smith?
Well, I just like to relate, probably for those who haven't gone through this process, and I personally have gotten a great deal of success in working informally with the counselors, and very frequently have avoided additional litigation, and don't feel that by my presence have formalized it to any greater degree, but in fact have been able to talk the same lingo as the counselor. Usually the parents and the juvenile in question aren't quite sure what's going on and why they're there and whether they should be entering into deals at this stage or not. I just think that I've speeded up the process many, many times and avoided lengthy court hearings and witness costs and everything by being there. And I've always viewed it that way. If I can handle it informally, I feel I'm doing a much greater service.
Person Mason.
I'd just like to second that. The contractor, the agreement can be a very, very good vehicle. In fact, I think you'll find defense attorneys pursuing this as an alternative. And that was the question I brought up last time, what happens when the child and the counselor agree and the district attorney doesn't. That would be a very interesting situation. I don't think it's resolved here because it's inevitable that it will happen, at least in Multnomah County, where there's full-time DAs there and they consider it their job to prosecute. There will come a time when an attorney and a counselor strike the bargain and there will be a howl will arise from the other room. But
that's a good point.
Further discussion? You want to pursue this?
Let's take a vote on it and report to the judge.
Okay. The motion is by Representative Frohmeyer to leave Section 6 of the bill. If there's no further discussion, call the roll.
Representative Frohmeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Nope.
Mason?
Nope.
Richard?
No.
Smith?
No.
Bugis?
No.
Cohen?
Aye.
That's for you, Dick.
Fantastic.
No.
Or one, Dick.
Fails.
As a non-jury, I just want my vote noted by the members of the bar of this
committee. That's my lawyer's name. Richard will get her bar certificate at the end of the sentence.
Okay, the further amendments on Senate Bill.
They can submit their examinations to one of the folks in the back of the room back there. They can have them graded.
Since Representative Frohmeyer won't do it, I will. 24 move that the terms or disposition will be bracketed and deleted.
Representative Lombard moves that on page 2 of the bill, line 24, that the words or disposition will be deleted. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just simply through my motion would say that I agree that it's probably appropriate that these types of agreements be part of the juvenile's record and that one be able to look at that. Some point in the future in a dispositional hearing. But I certainly do agree it ought not to be used in an adjudicatory hearing, and so that's why I would vote.
Is there further discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, adopted. For the motion,
Mr. Chairman.
Person Mason.
For the, as a topic of discussion, do we need anything here speaking to the idea that the agreement should contain all the agreements? The written agreement should. This kind of raises in my mind, the back of my mind, all that old contract law about collateral agreements and this type of thing and whether or not it's integrated. And then,
what?
That's okay. That's
the
term part.
I'm sorry, I was momentarily distracted. Did you repeat that?
Second year.
I'm not very good.
No. The term integrated means refers to the fact that everything in the contract is in the contract.
I think there isn't a presumption in the law that when you have a written agreement that unless there is...
You have a parole evidence rule problem anyway.
Yeah, that there's a...
I guess the question is, would the parole evidence rule apply? You're loving this, aren't you? Would the parole evidence apply here?
You're in over your head, Dan.
I think that it's a contract. If both parties have given up something, there's consideration, there are mutual promises, and... So it would
be on the court isn't bound because the DA, this is just between a counselor and
the
attorney.
I haven't thought about.
Should we put some statutory damages in?
Is it a viable?
There's class.
I'm probably ready to take a motion to build some floors or...
What is the, before you...
Mr. Molinar?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Molinari has made the suggestion that on line 31, perhaps the juvenile department counselor shall file a petition, that be changed to may file a petition, to give the counselor discretion in cases of revocation, whether he wants to proceed ahead with the case or drop it.
Anyone that wants to move that motion?
So moved.
Okay.
Then I imagine we need a may on the next one, too.
Right.
Okay.
Representative Smith moves in line 31, deletion of the word shall, and in line 30, and inserting may in its place in the same motion, or the same effect on line 32 of the bill. Is there discussion? Is there objection? If not, it's adopted. Representative Lombard now moves that Senate Bill 114 as amended be sent before the DuPage recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Representative Smith.
There was a suggestion in regard to Section 1 about shutting it down. Have we decided to leave it as it is, which would be my preference?
Nobody made a motion.
No one made a motion. Okay. I didn't see any great interest in that. Representative Bugis?
That was the same question.
Okay. Further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Richards?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Brunner?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Bugis?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes. Last bill on the agenda is House Bill 2936. This bill has previously been incorporated in other legislation passed out of the committee.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
It's my bill, and I will take the honor of moving to table it.
I didn't know it was tabled by the full committee on May 8th. Yeah, I did too.
Our records don't show it tabled, and somebody asked, called up, and we didn't get it tabled.
My records show the same thing.
My records show
My records are never wrong.
That's what mine show.
Well, I did it to the chairman twice.
He's moving it. Let's
do it. It'll be
tabled. Table it again.
Chair moves that House Bill 2936 be tabled for the second time.
Shouldn't we move to the table first?
Well, remember to
the table. I just want to make one report. It's a convenient time to report on the progress of 2198. I think this committee is interested in 2198.
Yes.
It hasn't moved anywhere yet, and I'm worried about it. We're going to meet with the staff of Legislative Fiscal next week to see where 2002 and 2198 are. And although you're tabling this now, it's a possibility, if there's any way to take a fiscal impact out of the bill that you end up sending out, I don't know how it would do it, but somehow or other, there are portions of 2198 which have to pass. And remember, it is a House bill, so you can put on notice.
There are things happening that I'll talk to you about.
Uh-huh.
Motion to table House Bill 2936 is non-debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
All right.
No.
Smith?
No.
Dugan?
Aye.
Tipton?
Aye.
Grunheim?
I'm so responsible, aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
You're loyal committee.
Yeah, we are.
I keep it alive, you know.
There's one quick item of business tonight, is I hope all of you will attend tonight, the Great Oregon Pie Committee. I think it'll be a good time, and it'll be a very short meeting. One of the more pleasant ones that this committee has had. For the business.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
President Dugan.
The bill to take a gun away from somebody.
A drunk?
Yeah.
A drunk.
That's probably died by passage of time, hasn't it?
Still has technical defects.
Any interest in that besides
well,
me?
Well, if you'll turn off the tape, I'll tell you a new story.
The problem with that bill is that
you've got the corner in the votes, huh?
Yeah, well, no. If the Republican members of this committee wanted to send the bill out, I'd be more than happy to do that. But there was a request for the committee to take a very long look, perhaps through the interim, and the technical defects in the bill by Representative Wilhelms. So perhaps if you would be interested in talking to him before you ask me again to schedule the bill.
You make a good point.
We were sent a bill from the floor. I'm trying to think, it was the on public utilities.
That's up tomorrow. Right.
It is tomorrow.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
with respect to that, I know Representative Lindquist has had legislative council draft proposed amendments. Are you aware of any other proposals or amendments that will be coming in from other parties?
I have just heard scuttlebutt that there may be something coming in from the utilities, but I don't know what it is.
Probably.
I don't know.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. Is there further business to come before the committee?
What happened to 111, Mr. Chairman?
111 was carried back to the subcommittee for Representative Lombard's amendments versus Cromer's amendments for the public hearings. Further business to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.